How many people know what Landauer erasure is in the audience? Okay. How many people know what majorization is? Everyone that attended Rob's talks. How many people could say what the three laws of thermodynamics were? Okay. So. So I guess what I'd like to do is first I'll kind of just talk about what quantum thermodynamics is or what thermodynamics is, and there's kind of a traditional way of looking at it where I don't really know what thermodynamics is, but at least I know what the consequences are, the three laws, and then I'll talk about thermodynamics as a resource theory and show how that's defined and show how that allows you to recast the laws of thermodynamics in a particular way. And I guess the main punchline one of the punchlines is that there's not going to be one second law, there's actually many second laws. Maybe I'll also talk a bit about something called embezzling work, where you see that if you're not careful, then you can always violate the second law, if you're not careful about how you define the second law. I could, depending on the time, I could talk about fluctuation relations. How many people have heard of know what those are, fluctuation relations? Like Jarzynski fluctuation relations? Okay. And quantum, in particular, quantum fluctuation relations. And I could also talk about the third law. We'll see how it goes. Good, so please interrupt me a lot with questions, because I guess this is not a thermodynamics audience, and so people shouldn't be ashamed. And also, it's a diverse audience from different fields. So I guess thermodynamics starts in kind of from a very experimental, initially it has roots in a very experimental tradition where you had people like Joule who converted work into heat by just, you know, having a paddle wheel that eventually heated up some water and measuring that. And so from kind of a very kind of phenomenological theory, then it became statistical mechanics with people like Maxwell and Boltzmann. I think now we understand it now as an information theory. And so I think there's almost like a third era of thermodynamics where we're understanding it in a kind of a much more rigorous way, and where we don't need to, in statistical mechanics, where you have to take the thermodynamic limit and go to very large systems, we're understanding that we don't need to take the thermodynamic limit. We can consider quantum systems or very small systems. And a lot of what I'm going to say is not necessarily, doesn't have to be quantum. If you want to come in, or people want to, not to put anyone on the spot who's lurking, but there's a few seats at the front. What I'm going to say is not just about quantum systems, but actually these many second laws, for example, arise when you just have small systems, so finite size systems. So a lot of what I'm going to be talking about is finite size effects as much as it is quantum effects. And both things occur. All right? So let me just quickly remind people of the three laws of thermodynamics. It's called the three laws of thermodynamics because there's four of them. The first is the zeroth law, which says that if I have some equilibrium system, let's call it tau 1, which is in equilibrium with tau 2, And tau 2 is in equilibrium with another, a third system, tau 3, then tau 1, that implies that tau 1 is in equilibrium with tau 3. Right? And you can think of that, the zeroth law, as defining what we mean by temperature. So all of these, we would say, are at the same temperature. So that's how temperature arises. This comes through the zeroth law. And then the first law is not really a law of thermodynamics, even though these are all set as laws of thermodynamics, but the first law is not really a law of thermodynamics, it's just conservation of energy, right? So it's just that the change in energy of my system is equal to some heat, so energy that comes from the heat bath and energy that comes from a work system. So the first law is just conservation of energy. That's not a law of thermodynamics, even though originally it was thought to be one, because it was originally discovered by, you know, taking a big a vat of water and heating it up with a paddle wheel. But we now understand it as conservation of energy. The second law, I'll give the Clausius statement, which is that heat, I'll give two versions actually. Heat can never pass from a cold system to a warm one without some other change occurring in the environment or elsewhere, okay? Occurring elsewhere. Okay. And there's a few questions about this. One of them is what we mean by some other change. And you immediately, when we're going to try and apply this and think about this in terms of a quantum system, we know that if we do something to a quantum system and we're manipulating it in some way, there will always be some other change occurring somewhere else, right? There's no way to actually do something with no other change occurring. So a question will arise is, what do we mean by no change occurring? And that's going to turn out to be quite problematic when we look at quantum systems, right? Because it's very difficult to define that. There's another way to think of the second law more quantitatively, which is just that the change in, if I define the free energy, which is the average energy of a system minus the temperature of a heat bath that the system is in contact with, times the entropy of that system, and we'll maybe say what we mean by that entropy, but let's take this just for the moment to be the von Neumann entropy and imagine the system's large. The free energy has to go down. So you can say the second law is that the free energy of a system, if no other change occurs, has to decrease. That's one version of the second law if we combine it with the first law. All right?
Maybe less than zero.
Oh, sorry. Well, I didn't say which way delta was defined. another way of saying it is that the work I get out has to always be, if I get some average work out of my system, then the work I get out will always be less than the change in the free energy. Okay, that's an inequality. We'll see if we have time that this inequality can actually be made into, there's actually an equality version of this. These are these so-called fluctuation relations, right? So here we might only care about the average value of the work. In a quantum system, the fluctuations can be much larger, and in small systems, the fluctuations are much larger. And we might care about more than just the average of quantities such as the work. We might care about, you know, all the moments of the work, for example, and you can make an equality version of the second law, which precisely defines what the distribution of work will be, because it's not some well-defined quantity, but it's rather a distribution of possible values of work. Right. And finally, the third law, which can't fit on the same blackboard, unfortunately. I'll put up in the corner so we can keep an eye on it. The third law is that it's impossible to reach absolute, it's impossible to cool the system to absolute zero in a finite number of steps. And I guess I like to think about these, what we'll see is that we can think about these things as the zeroth and the first law, in some sense, and especially the first law, are going to define what we mean by thermodynamics. So rather than think of these things as laws, we're going to take these to be defining what we mean by thermodynamics. Then the second law, we can think of as telling us what state transformations are possible. So the second law says that we can only go from one state to another if the entropy increases or if the free energy decreases. So it tells us what state transformations are possible. And the third law, we can think of some generalized third law, which tells us how fast can we go from one state to another. And in particular, sometimes it takes an infinite amount of steps or an infinite amount of time to get from one state to another. Right. Are there any questions about, yeah?
The delta F less than zero, are you assuming energy conservation?
Am I assuming energy is conserved? No. So when I said this was energy conservation, I just mean energy overall. So the total energy is conserved. Some of it is work, some of it's heat. But in a particular system, it can change because I can add work to my system or not. Here, I don't want to have any other change occurring, but I'm allowed to put it in contact with the heat bath. Okay. But I'm not allowed to add work to it. I can put it in contact with the work system as well, but I just shouldn't pump work into it, because that would result in some other change occurring, in particular in the work system.
So yeah. Should I think of the second law as like just an assumption that you're placing on the system that you're going to study, the processes that you're going to study?
We will find out that we can derive rigorously a second law, and in fact many second laws.
Okay, even though you're sort of defining the processes that are allowed by being the ones that actually satisfy?
No, I'm not doing that. Oh. Why do I? So here I talk about processes. So the processes are ones, I guess we'll need to define that, so we'll get to that. But the processes generally are ones which cannot have any other change occurring elsewhere. But other than that, they're not defined. And I think one of the problems with thermodynamics, the reason I found it difficult to learn thermodynamics when I was a student, was that no one ever told me what thermodynamics was. I was always been doing adiabats and isotherms and isocores and a whole bunch of things, but there was never someone that said, okay, no, but this is what you're allowed to do and this is what you're not allowed to do. And I think that's what we want to do here, is we want to rigorously define what thermodynamics is. Okay. Any other questions about standard thermodynamics? Okay, so let's define what it is. And for those of you that were in Rob's talk, this comes from the, a lot of what I'm gonna say will have echoes in entanglement. It's inspired by entanglement theory, where we want to precisely define what the rules of the game are. In some sense, this gives a resource. This is called resource theory. But in another way, it's really just being rigorous and defining what you're allowed to do and what you're not allowed to do. So a resource theory is just a class of operations. So So we have a class of operations. In general, this will be some class C, right? Just for example, LOCC in entanglement theory, it's going to be called thermal operations for thermodynamics. And that induces, if you have a class of operations, it induces free states, right? Those are the states that are for free that I can create under the class of operations. So separable states under LOCC, let's call this curly F. So free states the class of operations. And the free states, so separable states, if LOCCs are class of operations. The anyone want to guess what the free states are for thermodynamics?
Gibbs.
Yeah, they're going to turn out to be the Gibbs states. We're not going to put that in by hand. That will come out in some way. And then the free energy is going to emerge as a monotone under this class of operations. So let's say that I have some distance measure. So let's say the class of operations, let's call a particular operation lambda, a particular operation under this class, C. Okay. Then let's say I have a contractive distance measure. So for example, the relative entropy is a contractive distance measure, meaning that if I act the if I act an operation on a state, then this thing goes down, right? So if this thing is always smaller than d of rho, sorry, that's what I want to call sigma here. Okay, so we have some. So imagine we have some contractive distance measure. So this is the distance between rho and some state sigma. If it's contractive under the class of operations, then we can use this distance measure to give us a monotone, a function, which tells us whether we can make a state transformation. In particular, let's take a measure to be d of, take it to be the I want it to be the smallest. So the infimum over all free states sigma, and take the distance measure to sigma. Okay, this thing is a monotone. All right. Do people see that? The reason is as follows, that if I look at, let's call this thing.
C keeps F in itself. Is it a relation?
This thing? So if you have a resource theory, the free states, they're creatable under the class of operations. You can't get out of them, right? So everything else is a resource. So rho, for example, may be some resource. So let's call this thing F. Let's call this thing FC. And it's easy to see that it's a monotone, because if I now take the class of operations, act it on this thing, then this will also be a good F, right? Because As you said, the class of operations will keep you inside the set of free states, and so let's just write that out. So if we take infimum of sigma over F of some particular d rho and act the class of operations on this thing, then this thing is equal to some d, the same d of rho prime to some sigma prime, but this thing here is a particular element of C. This thing is a particular element of the free states, and so this thing has to be I want to take the infimum, so this thing is less than d of rho is less than the infimum. Sorry, right, greater than the antinomy of sigma and lambda f of d rho prime to sigma. Okay. So this thing is always going down. So an example. So I will tell you what thermal operations are. We'll see that the free state in that case is the Gibbs state, and so a relevant measure is the relative entropy distance to the Gibbs state, which is just a free energy. All right, and we'll see that there's a whole bunch of other free energies.
You are able to move along different temperatures when you do the minimization there, or just you keep one there?
No, so what we're going to do, so I'll say what the class of operations are, and it's in contact with a single heat bath. If you want to consider other heat baths, then they become part of your system. So I'll say what thermal, so let me give the class of thermal operations. So the resource theory of thermal operations I have some system S, which comes with a Hamiltonian H, so that's just given as kind of it's given as the system or the resource, and I'm going to operate on that. I'm allowed to put this the system in contact with some free state tau, and this will turn out to be the Gibbs state. I'll label it by beta, but I'm not going to tell you that it's the Gibbs state. I'm just going to, for the moment, just say that there exists free states. And it'll emerge as a property of this resource theory that the only free states that you're allowed are the Gibbs state, and if you use any other state, the resource theory will become trivial. All right. So there'll be some set of free states, T beta, with some Hamiltonian HR. I'm allowed to choose any Hamiltonian I want. And then we're going to allow you to have a work system. So some work system W, and here it turns out not to depend on what kind of work system you use, but will be specific, and it'll often be worthwhile to be specific, where we'll take the Hamiltonian of the work system to just be some level, let's do this, some and we'll actually take this to be the infinite double ladder. So we'll let omega n go just be integers from minus infinity to positive infinity. Right. So that's our work system. So we have a work system, we have a reservoir, and our system itself that we're interested in. And the basic idea here is we want to be very explicit about all the physical assumptions we're making. So rather than just considering work to be the change in energy of our system and bath, which is often the case, we want to put a particular work system in. We want to put a heat bath in, and we want to make these all physical systems that we have to act upon, right? And then finally, we're allowed to do any unitary on all these systems, and so we have some unitary U, and we want this unitary to conserve energy. All right, so it should conserve total energy, and if it needs to conserve energy for any input state, and conserve energy exactly, so we don't want it just to conserve energy on average, because energy is conserved exactly, so we want it to commute with all the total energy. All right. And this is a very strong constraint in some sense. Of course, it's a very real constraint, so energy is conserved. So we have to impose this constraint if we're including everything in our system, if we include everything in our universe, you know, if we're making sure we account for all sources of energy. The reason we impose it is that we want to make sure we don't cheat, because thermodynamics is the theory of, and it's the theory of energy in some sense, right? Energy and entropy. And we want to make sure that we account for all sources of energy. So if you, if we're going to manipulate a system and some energy gets added in, we want to make sure that we count that, Right? So if energy gets added in, it either must be coming from the reservoir or it must be coming from the work system. We want to include it as either work or heat. Right? We don't want to be cheating. Is that clear why we impose that constraint? That's right. Yeah.
So now the interactions are in U.
That's right. So the interaction is the way of coupling. So you're basically you're allowing the experimenter to couple the system, the bath, in any way they want. Now there's lots of ways. You may imagine that you put in an interaction Hamiltonian. You may imagine that you have a time dependent. Some people would like a time dependent Hamiltonian, but you can mock everything up in some sense by just including, say, a clock or something like that. So you can, everything can be made into a time dependent, independent, into a unitary and a total time independent Hamiltonian. All right. One more constraint is that we're going to demand that this unitary commute with translations of our work system. Let's call it a battery or a weight. All right. We want to commute with translations of the weight. And the reason is that we want to think of work as, you know, and classically we think of work as we imagine we have maybe a big weight like this, and doing work means lifting up the weight or lowering the weight, right? Work is a process that happens on another system. We do work, we raise it or lower it. And we don't want that process to depend on where the weight is. We might think, so another way of thinking about it is that we want that this rope is, in some sense, an idealized system where we can raise it or lower it by an arbitrary amount. Right? We're not at the end of the rope. So if translations of the weight are given by delta, so let's call delta, we have delta HW, if delta equals minus I, then we want the final constraint is that the unitary commutes with delta. Right. Any questions about thermal operations? Yeah.
If you need to define a translation operator, you will need the n to be range from negative infinity to positive infinity.
Right.
Which means it does not have a ground state.
Right.
So is that a problem? Because you cannot define a thermal state, a proper thermal state.
Right. I think it's an idealization. So you're imagining that you. I could actually imagine it's bounded from below, but I'm not nowhere close to it, and that it effectively commutes on the initial states that I'm interested in, which are those that are far away from the bottom. So in that sense, it's an idealization.
WN are not all the same, right?
It doesn't really matter, but they could, in this case, I'm just having them be the integers. So I'm taking the doubly infinite ladder. You can have it bounded from below and just imagine that you're far enough, you're high enough, so n is large enough. Your initial state is high enough that you don't need to worry about hitting the bottom of the ladder. So this is the thing. I want to give the broadest notion of thermodynamics. I'm interested in fundamental limitations. So I let the experimenter do any u allowed by the laws of physics as long as it satisfies these constraints. So I guess in contrast to when people were previously studying particular models or they were studying a particular engine or something like this, I want to let the experimenter do whatever they want. And that way I can study some fundamental limitations. Right? There's a modification of this you might want to consider called catalytic thermal operations. Why do I demand this? Because I want to consider, there's two reasons. One is I want to consider work to be a process. So work for me is the raising and lowering of the weight. And so that shouldn't depend on where the weight is. It just is. So if I think of another way of thinking about it is, imagine we didn't include a work system and we just implicitly want to account for all sources of energy. So we would not have a work system, and then if there was any change in energy of the system and heat bath, we would say, oh, that must have come from the work system. And an equivalent way of saying that is this, that it should commute with translations, because I only care about differences in energy. I don't care about absolute values of energy. So work is just a difference in energy. Right. Any other questions about that? I want work to be a difference in energy, so that's the way of saying that. You can incidentally show that if this unitary has to commute with translations of the weight, then it acts as a mixture of unitaries on the system and bath. So it's another way also, what it also happens to do is it ensures that the experimenter doesn't take entropy and smuggle it, say, into the weight. It doesn't allow you to pump entropy into the weight. All right. So in some sense, it's what's going to help enforce the second law. So catalytic thermal operations, I'm going to add another thing, which is I'm going to allow borrowing some other catalyst, we call it, in state sigma C with Hamiltonian HC, as long as it's returned in the same state. And again, the question of what does it mean same state will arise. And we're going to include that there because you might imagine you have some machine which acts cyclically, just like in the Clausius statement of the second law, and that machine we can think of as a catalyst. It is allowed to act and try and, say, do work or act on the system, but in the end the machine is returned back into its original state. That's a cyclic process, and then we want to know what state transformations are possible. Okay. So we'll call this thermal operations. So either we'll call it either CTO or just TO, thermal operations. Okay. Good. Okay, so the first thing we get is a zeroth law. And the zeroth law is that the only state you're allowed here is the Gibbs state. If you don't have the Gibbs state, then you can draw an arbitrary large amount of work for free. All right? And the reason is that the Gibbs state has a property of, so the zeroth law is any state but Gibbs. So it's like, let's see, tau beta is equal to e to the minus beta hr over Z, or we can draw an arbitrary large amount of work. And the reason just is that the any other state what will happen is that there will be some the chance of you being at a higher energy level can be larger than being at a lower energy level. There will exist two energy levels where the probability of being at one at that higher level is higher than the probability of being at a lower level, and you can exploit that to draw an arbitrary large amount of work just by swapping this level for this level. It's due to a notion of called complete passivity, which I'll maybe move on and we can, if I get a chance to talk about it later, I will. But you can show that this is due to a result of Pushin-Voronovich that complete passivity. That the only state which is completely passive is the Gibbs state, and if a state is not completely passive, then you can use it to extract an arbitrary large amount of work using the resource theory of thermal operations. So this instantly gives you a The only resource theories which are allowed are ones which have a single temperature beta, and so you get the notion of temperature emerging very naturally, right? Because the only free states are the ones which have the same temperature.
Why can't you have an ensemble of states at different temperatures? Suppose I just had like an integral over betas or something?
Right, well then I could extract an arbitrary large amount of work. So the resource theory becomes trivial because all state transformations become possible. Right, if I'm allowed as free states with even just two different temperatures, then I can use those two different temperatures to extract a whole bunch of work. And then if you want to ask me what state transformations are possible, I say everything because I have this huge resource of work.
But you don't actually have access to both of them. You only have access to one or the other. So, you know, suppose you put probability.
Right.
It's an ensemble. So I don't quite understand.
Well, so you're right. It divides your free states into an equivalence class of different temperatures. So you're only allowed to use one for a particular, you know, any particular instance, for example. But yeah, all temperatures are allowed, but you choose one and you start. And if you're allowed two, then you can extract an arbitrary large amount of work, and the resource theory is trivial. If you're allowed two at the same time.
But HR is arbitrary.
It's allowed to be arbitrary, yeah.
So this state can be any. So it means you just change the Hamiltonian.
That's right.
Okay, so you are not imposing anything there. So it's not telling you something.
Right, so maybe I should say that you know, you're picking a rho beta and an HR. So you have to tell me what HR is, and then that will then tell me what unitaries I'm allowed. So you can't, I mean, you can pick any state you want, but that fixes HR. You can pick any state you want, that fixes a temperature in an HR. And then given that HR, I won't be able to extract any work.
Here, the transformations are given by you.
That's right. The experimenter you can think of as the experimenter is coming and implementing some U, and we're interested in what state transformations are possible. Are there any questions? Okay. So the first thing is that this class of operations has the property that it preserves the Gibbs state. All right. So if I act any thermal operations, let's call it lambda on the Gibbs state on tau beta, then we get tau beta.
Can you clarify that? Because this U acts on the Hilbert space of the three things.
Right.
So
I should say, okay, good. So if it's a cyclic process. So let me specify that it's a cyclic process. So if it's cyclic, so the work system has to be returned back to its original state. Same with any catalysts. So if I act a cyclic process, then it will preserve the Gibbs state.
The cyclic process is defined as the work system is equivalent to the initial state.
Yeah, so the work system has to be back in its initial state, and any catalyst has to be put back in their initial state. So any cyclic process preserves the Gibbs state.
Does that mean that if and only, do all operations that preserve the Gibbs state, are they allowed?
That's a very good question. So it turns out that for states which are quasi-classical, so I can imagine states for which rho s commutes with hs. So these are like classical states in some sense. So these are what we'll call quasi-classical. For those, it's an if and only if. So it's a thermal operation if and only if it preserves the Gibbs state. For states which have coherences over energy levels, then it turns out that it's not. It's a wider class. Operations which preserve the Gibbs state are a wider class of operations. In particular, they can create coherences over energy levels, which cannot be done using thermal operations. So one of the things about thermal operations is if you start off with a state which is quasi-classical, it stays quasi-classical, at least if it's a cyclic process.
That is just an Einstein thing, no? It doesn't need to be quasi-classical.
Sorry.
That equation the one you just wrote,
this one,
yes. That just means that rho s is an Langer state of HS.
Well, it could be, it's block diagonal.
Yeah. But that doesn't mean.
So if it's degenerate, then it can be
anything. That doesn't mean that it's classical at all, but it could be very quantum.
Sure, it depends on what you're. Yeah, so I'm using. There's different notions of classicality, but there's a sense in which in things that are diagonal in the energy eigenbasis behave very classically in some ways, whereas states which have superpositions over energy levels are much more puzzling and have certain quantum properties. But you're right. I mean, in some sense, I'm just specifying a basis, and it's just the coinciding of a basis.
So, but if the cyclic process gives the warp system is again in the same state, and the Gibbs state is again in the same state, then the entropy is not generated anywhere.
If I act, well, if I act something on the Gibbs state, then I'll say what the laws are. But if I act on the Gibbs state, yeah, then nothing happens. I mean, you can just see that's quite obvious, right? If I act this on the Gibbs state, I can tensor the Gibbs state to it, and I can do a unitary. Well, acting a unitary on the Gibbs state doesn't change it. It's still the Gibbs state. At least if it's an energy-conserving unitary, it just acts trivially on the Gibbs state. All right? Good. So let's take for a moment HS. Let's take HS and HR equal to zero, just so you can see a little toy theory. So there's like a little thermodynamics for children. If HS and HR equal zero, then the statement that you preserve the Gibbs state is just the statement that you preserve the maximally mixed state, right? So then lambda is a doubly stochastic map. Which just means it preserves the Gibbs state. Or sorry, the maximally mixed state. And people maybe know that if a map is doubly stochastic, if and only if, so if I have a map which is doubly stochastic and I want to know, can I go from some rho to some sigma, all right, using this map lambda, then I can go if and only if, with a doubly stochastic map, if and only if rho majorizes sigma, all right? So majorization, majorization in the case of a degenerate Hamiltonian, majorization is like a second law, all right? And so majorizations are just a lot stronger than saying that the entropy has to, in this case, the entropy has to increase. Right? So you have, in this sense, you have many second laws, the majorization. So it can be, for example, that the entropy is increasing, but the majorization constraints are not, don't go with you. So for example, you might say, I want to increase the entropy but lower the rank of the density matrix. You cannot do that, even though the ordinary second law tells you you could do that. Or you might want to have a map which, again, increases the entropy but also increases the largest eigenvalue. Well, that again violates the majorization criteria, and that's not allowed, even though it satisfies the ordinary second law. So there's a whole bunch of additional constraints which tell you whether you can go from some state rho to some state sigma. And so there's, even for this simple case, there's many second laws because the majorization becomes second laws. Is there a question about that? Okay. Additionally, since we have a preservation of the Gibbs state, we can go back to what I talked about more generally there, and I can consider, for example, the relative entropy, so let's call it D1, the relative entropy distance to the Gibbs state. Okay? So that just equals trace of rho log rho minus trace of rho log sigma, sorry, tau in this case, And if you just do a quick, if you just quickly check, you can see that this is just the average energy minus TS. So it's the free energy minus the minus TS. Sorry, I'll take a T there. Multiply this thing by T. So multiply this thing by T. It's equal to the free energy plus log Z. So you can think of it like it's kind of the difference in free energy between your state and the Gibbs state, right? So what the in this case, what the second law, the monotonicity of the relative entropy, what it tells you is that you have to get closer to the Gibbs state. You go closer to the thermal state.
So you got the same Hilbert space, with rho S and this tau beta in the same Hilbert space.
No. In the class of operations, it doesn't have to be. But here, when I'm writing these monotones, it is. Right? So, I mean, I can put as the inputs, so the system can be also a Gibbs state. This Gibbs state is the free state that I'm allowed to add, but I can also consider the input system to be a Gibbs state. And so when I use this monotonicity, the contractiveness of this map to get a monotone, then I'm looking at how close the state is to its own Gibbs state. So this statement in finding a monotone, it's true for the relative entropy distance, but it's true for any contractive map. So in particular, we're going to take the Renyi divergences. So people know the Renyi entropies? Okay. So there's something called the Renyi divergences. They're kind of, if I think of the Renyi entropies as being a generalization of the entropy, then the Renyi divergences are a generalization of the relative entropy distance. Right? So the Renyi divergences are defined as d alpha equals trace rho to the alpha. It's a distance, so let's go d alpha of rho to sigma. Sigma to alpha. And there's a 1 over 1 minus alpha. Okay. In the limit that alpha goes to 1, this thing is just the ordinary relative entropy. Okay. So the limit that this thing goes to 1, that's the ordinary relative entropy. So now here we have that d alpha to the Gibbs state gives us monotones, is a monotone under thermal operator. It's a monotone. It turns out to be a monotone not only under just thermal operations, but also catalytic thermal operations. Okay. The second thing you can show is that these set of monotones are if and only if. So under thermal operations, I can go from rho to sigma under, say, catalytic thermal operations, if and only if the d alphas go down. So rho to tau beta is larger than d alpha sigma to tau beta, right? So if these Renyi divergences, if they go down, then I can go from rho to sigma.
Is this for all alpha or some other?
This is true for alpha. For alpha, all alpha greater than 0. Are there any? The other thing is that if I now take my system to be macroscopic. So I now take, if I now look at the thermodynamic limit, and I compute these d alphas, then it turns out that in the thermodynamic limit, they're all approximately equal to d1. Okay. So they're just so you have many second laws for small systems, but in the thermodynamic limit for large systems, you only you retrieve the ordinary second law. So it collapses back to the ordinary second law.
Yeah. How do you see that?
It's probably easier to see it with majorization, which I maybe can do. Okay. Let me just write this down in the thermodynamic limit. Maybe a way to see it is, or another way to see it is, take the Reni, take all the Reni entropy. Think of it; it's very similar to what happens with the Reni entropies. Take all the Reni entropies, and now look at the uniform distribution. Look at the uniform distribution. The Renis are all equal for the uniform distribution, and so if you have a large system, what happens is you pretty much go to the uniform distribution, and that's just the law of large numbers. So it's like if you toss many coins, then you know the almost all sequences of coin tosses have 50% heads, 50% tails. Very few have all tails, and so all roughly almost all the state space has uniform probability, close to uniform probability, and so all the Reni entropies become equal to the ordinary entropy, the von Neumann entropy. And the same thing happens with the Reni divergences. Okay, we're about to run out of time. So maybe I'll say this follows from kind of a generalization of majorization. There's something a bit remarkable, which is that here I've allowed any unitary that you could possibly imagine, right, including ones which access the microscopic states of the heat bath. Right? And that's quite surprising that I still have these second laws, even though I'm allowed to access microscopic degrees of freedom of the heat bath. It turns out that you can have a very a different resource theory. We call it crude operations, where we're not allowed any unitary at all. All we're allowed to do is put energy levels in thermal contact and change the Hamiltonian of the system. So in ordinary thermodynamics, you can't access the microscopic heat bath. All you can do, degrees of freedom of the heat bath, all you can do is push a piston in and out, which is like changing the Hamiltonian of the system, and put it in thermal contact. And it turns out that you can have a quantum version of that, which is universal for thermal operations in a kind of a related way as for quantum computation, we have a set of gates which can do any unitary. You have a very simple set of operations which can implement all these. So it seems a bit surprising that you can. Why do you get these second laws when you're allowed to access microscopic degrees of freedom? And I guess the kind of the reason that you get that comes about because accessing those microscopic degrees of freedom doesn't really give you any more power, just like a Maxwell's demon doesn't get any more power if the demon knows gains information.
So far you are constraining the unitaries, no? By saying that you can only that you left leave invariant the Gibson symbol, no? In the reservoir.
Sorry.
You leave invariant the reservoir. That's a constraint on the unitaries. No? Not all unitaries are going to leave invariant the Gibson symbol.
No, all unitaries here which are cyclic. So any unitary which leaves the work system back in its original state and conserves energy will leave invariant the Gibbs state. Right, so even though you can access these microscopic degrees of freedom, you can't get away from the Gibbs state. You can move them around in a whole bunch of different ways, but you'll still just get back the Gibbs state. And it's because, similar with like the maximally mixed state, if you are only allowed to do a unitary on the maximally mixed state, there's not much you can do. It stays the maximally mixed state.
The work system is a tensor product with the rest of
right? Initially, yes.
Initially.
Yes.
Okay, so the monotonicity comes from the fact that the final state is generally entangled, something like that.
Sorry?
The final state is generally entangled. Even if the state in the work system is the same,
yes.
You have some...
There could be, yes. There could be. So I'll just end with... let me just end with... Maybe I'll just quickly mention one final thing, because you're mentioning that we're talking about the work system. There is a equality version of this second law. So we have the ordinary second law says that the average work has to be less than the free energy. You have equality when you have a reversible process, but in an irreversible process, the work will be less. And you have an equality version of the second law, which I'll just write down here. So equality version of second law. There's a few different versions of this. They're related to Jarzynski and Crookes equations. It's that the expectation value of E to the W, so imagine that the work, we get a particular amount of work in a particular process. So now we're allowed, because in non-cyclic processes where we gain or use up work, that has to be equal to the change, E to the change in free energy. So I have a data there. Okay. So that's an equality. If you Taylor expand it, you get the ordinary inequality version of the second law, but you also have higher order corrections. So you have higher order corrections to it, and it's an equality in general. So this is now telling you about all the different fluctuations you can have in work, whereas the ordinary second law just tells you some equality about the average work. So you get a much more fine-grained understanding of the work fluctuations in this case, which for a quantum system can be very large. Okay. So I've run out of time, and I'll end there and then take questions for those people who want to stay. Thank you very much.
Derive that?
The Jarzynski equation.
Yes.
It's quite beautiful, actually. You can derive it very quickly from. So I mentioned this notion of doubly stochastic. If you have doubly stochastic map, it comes effectively from that. So there's a Gibbs stochastic map. So doubly stochastic means preserving the maximally mixed state. If I have a Gibbs stochastic map, meaning I preserve the Gibbs state, then it looks like this. So I have some map which I can think of like this. So it's a map is a conditional probability distribution, right? So this is, means take an if initially the state is S, then this is the probability that S goes to S prime with the work W. All right? So I acted on the Gibbs state. Sum over all S prime. Sum over all S, sorry. And then that has to equal E to the minus beta E S prime, right? So that's the condition for preserving the Gibbs state. And now you can see that from this, if you now multiply both sides by P of S prime and sum over S prime, you get this. You get this fluctuation relation. So it follows just from this kind of doubly stochastic or Gibbs stochastic condition. And this Gibbs stochastic condition is equivalent to something like a majorization constraint. So this fluctuation relation is actually weaker than the majorization condition. Yeah.
So you were mentioning that there are these fluctuation relations, possibly which were also due to distance theory, something like this that you didn't get to. Are these, so to what degree are these like your generalizations of like fluctuation dissipation theorem or something like this? Well, how do they, what is the character of these?
Right? Yeah, I don't know that there are, I should know this, and I don't.
Okay.
But I don't think they're related.
Okay. Well, what do they say?
Maybe I won't say anything about something I don't know anything about.
Okay. But what do those say?
The
fluctuation relations.
Oh, so here's an example of one. Okay. So this is one of them. We've discovered these kind of more fine-grained ones, which are related to. The Gibbs stochastic condition, which I wrote somewhere here. So these give you kind of more fine-grained ones than just this fluctuation relation. And you also have quantum, fully quantum ones, where so here, you know, the work is just it's changing energy. It's kind of a classical thing in some ways. You can get a fluctuation relation which has to do with operators and expectation values of kind of decoherent operators. So you get fully quantum ones as well. So there's a whole bunch of them which are related to Jarzynski, and something called a Crookes relation, which relates the forward process to the backwards process. Okay.
So suppose that you want to write this equation there, but for density matter is also mathematical equation. What
this
is
thing?
The mathematical equation? It's exponential of relative entropy equal to something.
This thing here.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so this is the mathematics is just this thing here. So if I were to now multiply this thing by a PS prime, then from this I would just get a process, and I would get an expectation value over a process of this random variable W. So if I have a work system now, I need to add a work system. I add a beta W here. This turns out to be true. This turns out to be a true equation, which tells you. So an operation is thermal if and only if it obeys this equation here with a fluctuating work system. So if I don't have a work system, it's a cyclic process. If I add in a work system, then the thermal operation has to obey this equation. And now if I just multiply this thing by P of S prime and sum, you'll get that equation there.
I was thinking, it's like exponential of relative entropy between two density matrices, something like that.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm going from some initial state to some final state. So it's the change in free energy of the initial state to the final state. And here you just have you drive your process, and any process you get some work out of it. The process must be such that it drives you from the initial state to the final state.
Okay.
And so here, this expectation value is over the process, so it's over some map. So I can think of it as like it's some e to the beta w, p of s, s prime w, and now I just sum over all s, s prime w. Okay, that's the left-hand side is this.
How do you prove that when HF equals to HR equals to zero, all some operations are doubly stochastic?
So to show that, you can see that these things will have to preserve the maximally mixed state. If you're acting on the maximally mixed state, any unitary will just preserve any unitary acting on the maximally mixed state will preserve the maximally mixed state, right?
With doubly stochastic, maybe you also want not only to preserve the maximally mixed state, but also to make all other states not stable, no, and go to the maximally mixed state.
That's a consequence, but if I just have that it preserves the maximally mixed state, then that will be a consequence.
And that will be a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Good. Okay, well, thanks very much.